Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we follow up on a film project about Wilhelm Reich. In August of 2012, we spoke with Kevin Hinchey, one of the directors of the Wilhelm Reich Infant Trust in Rangeley, Maine, which operates the Wilhelm Reich Museum. We talked with Kevin about his progress in producing a factually accurate full-length documentary film on the life and work of psychiatrist, research physician, and scientist Wilhelm Reich. As many know, Oregon Energy was discovered by Wilhelm Reich. It's been described as a massless, omnipresent substance that can coalesce to create organization on all scales. Within the microscopic, it's called bions, and the macroscopic structures would be clouds and even galaxies. Wilhelm Reich also constructed what was known as cloudbusters. He called it cosmic orgone engineering. A past guest, Dr. Konstantin Korotkov, measured etheric energy and orgone energy. He used electrophotonics, and it's based on the gas discharge visualization processes. Orgone energy is real. It has been scientifically measured, and yet the deliberate misrepresentation of orgone energy and Reich's work continues to this day. What is it within the work of Wilhelm Reich that could be so threatening that would marshal unprecedented resources and energy to try and eradicate his discoveries from the historic record? We welcome back Kevin Hinchey to talk about his current research on Wilhelm Reich and the progress on the documentary film project. Kevin, welcome back to Another News.
Thanks. It's great to be here again.
Well, Kevin, in our last interview, late summer of 2012, you were at that time writing a full-length documentary on the life of psychiatrist, research physician, and scientist Wilhelm Reich. And you mentioned that the storyline for the documentary is complete. Can you give us a sense of what it took to create and research this narrative?
Yeah, and I didn't realize it was so long since we spoke. In a sense, this has been a culmination of several decades of work. I first started reading Reich when I was 18. I'm 60 years old now. And so throughout my life, I've read everything that Reich has published in English, his books and his research journals and bulletins. But I was just reading them to read them. I was not reading them in anticipation of ever putting together a documentary. But once I decided to do the documentary, I felt there was a need for a documentary a few years ago. I had to go back and reread all this material specifically to look for a documentary film storyline and to connect the dots from all these various materials. So in terms of the materials that I have read, it's all of Reich's published books in English, 22, 23 books. His published research journals from 1942 to 1946. That alone is over 7,000 pages of published materials. I also looked at all of the government files on Reich, the American government files on Reich, from the State Department, the FBI, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and then the FDA, which is the one that was the agency that really got him at the end. That was thousands of pages of other materials. And then also, I spent a considerable amount of time at Reich's archives at the Conway Library of Medicine at Harvard, looking at unpublished materials. So I was looking at hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of other material. And like I say, I was really connecting the dots to come up with a viable film storyline.
Can you tell listeners a little bit about your structure and organizing this volume of information? How are you able to do this? Because one person pouring through this information, and it's not very easy to absorb. How did you do it?
Well, I probably could. It's a really good question. And your description of it as a volume of information is absolutely accurate. This is a volume of information here. I'm looking at it right now. And I could not have compiled this volume of information, this storyline, in 4 years if I hadn't spent all those years back there originally getting familiar with the material. And so it was really that familiarity with the material over many decades that really enabled me, once I had made up my mind that I needed to put together a storyline for a documentary film, my familiarity with these materials really helped me to know what I had to look at when for particular periods of Reich's life. So I already had a good overview of the chronology of Reich's life and the logical progression of his work. And in actually writing now sequences and a storyline, I knew which books to go to. I knew which bulletins to go to. I knew which excerpts of his published diaries and letters I could go to. I knew, in a general way, at least where to look for materials in the archives, because one of my roles as a co-director of the Wilhelm Reich Infant Trust is to help administer these archives and to help scholars find what they need in these archives. And so having that experience since 2007 helped me to really find what I was looking for in the archives. So it was a very labor-intensive process over the last 4 years, which would not have been possible without all of those years that came before it.
Kevin, can you give listeners an overview of Wilhelm Reich's life? I suspect there is probably a handful of people that may not be familiar with Reich and his work because of the intended blackout on his life's work.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Reich started out as a psychoanalyst and a psychiatrist, a student of Freud's, and he was basically attracted to the idea that Freud had first postulated and then abandoned, that the libido could in fact be a real tangible biological energy. And Reich pursued these ideas. He pursued that idea as a psychoanalyst, as a psychiatrist. He started investigating basic energy functions in primitive life forms such as protozoa and amoeba, in which he discovered new microorganisms which seemed to contain some sort of radiation. And it is through his biological work, which evolved from his psychoanalytic and psychiatric work, it was through these biological studies that he in fact discovered a new form of radiation that he called orgone energy, an actual physical biological energy in living tissue. And he later discovered this energy existed in the atmosphere, and his biological studies led him into the area of cellular research, cancer research, eventually into the experimental treatment of cancer patients with a medical and scientific tool that he evolved from Faraday cages, a medical and scientific tool called the orgone accumulator. And it is the orgone accumulator which really became the focal point of the Food and Drug Administration in this country, their investigation of Reich. They quite honestly believe that he was a medical and scientific charlatan. And it was this specific device, this modified Faraday cage called an orgone accumulator, that became the focal point of their investigation and ultimately would lead to the banning and burning of his books in America in 1960. And then again in 1956, first while he was alive, and then again 3 years after his death in 1960, they burned his books again.
From what you've gathered already about the FDA's witch hunt on Reich, how are they able to gather information to show that Reich's work with the orgone accumulator was not what he said it was?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And the reading the FDA files themselves is fascinating because you can really, really see a storyline, the thread and various plot threads and personalities moving throughout this investigation, which actually begins in August of 1947 and will go on through the 50s, et cetera. And it's not that there is any documentation of the FDA proving that Reich's work was not what he said it was. It was a feeling that they initially had that this was quackery. And then later on, when they do allegedly do some replication of his tests, there is no indication that they were really following the protocols, the scientific protocols that Reich had established in his writings. And one of the things about Reich's work, his laboratory work, specifically with this biological and atmospheric energy called orgone energy, you know, these are energy phenomena that have to be investigated under certain conditions. You need high-powered microscopes for your biological work. Other experiments need to take place over long periods of time. It's not something that you can turn on and off with a switch, or phenomenon that you can immediately recognize. And all of these various protocols are very clearly documented in his publications and his books and his research journals. And it becomes clear by reading some of the FDA reports, when they do talk about replications, that they have not really adhered to some of these protocols. But from the beginning, and I mean from the very beginning, they were convinced that this man was a charlatan. It's very, very clear there in some of the first internal reports within the FDA that their minds were made up very, very early on. It's also very clear very, very early on that they had a pornographic sensibility about Reich's work. And I guess I should step back and just say that the FDA investigation was precipitated by a single magazine article, which appeared in New Republic magazine in May of 1947. This article found its way to the FDA. It had a lot of false allegations in there. And but this becomes the really precipitating factor in starting the FDI investigation. So what they're really doing is looking at this article almost as gospel in terms of many of the false allegations there, and it kind of colors their perception of Reich from the very beginning. And so the conclusion you come to, it's almost an inescapable conclusion after you pour through these hundreds and hundreds of pages of just the FDA investigation, is that they honestly believed that Reich was a medical and scientific charlatan. You hear a lot of people with, excuse me, all kinds of conspiratorial views, and some may be valid, and you will sometimes hear this idea of the government was suppressing Reich's work, wanted to suppress it. My interpretation of the word suppress is to know something is potentially true, and you don't want people to know it. That's my interpretation. And so if we're going with that interpretation or that definition of the word suppress, I come across not one shred of evidence that the FDA was trying to suppress something. They honestly believed that this was quackery and charlatanism, and that they were really adhering to their obligations, and they were following really the guidelines of something called the Pure Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938, and they thought that this was a medical charlatan who was profiting by the sale and the rental of these fraudulent devices called orgone energy accumulators. So I think they were very sincere in their misguided notions about Reich, but you never really get a sense of fair play there from the beginning. Their minds are already made up.
Kevin, I think what you've done here is very, very important research work, you know, specifically focusing in on the FDA files that you've researched. And there are State Department files and FBI files.
Yes.
Was the FBI investigating Reich without his knowledge?
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that I find very impressive, and I say that in a negative way, is that during Reich's time in America, And he arrives in America on August 28th, 1939. That's the day he steps foot, off a ship in New York City to begin his life in America. That is 4 days before the beginning of World War II. He is essentially getting out of Europe by the skin of his teeth. He was a left-wing activist. He was an anti-fascist. He had a Jewish background. There's no way, I think, that he would have survived the war. So he comes here, and for the rest of his life, he is almost continually, not continually, almost continually investigated by four different government agencies at different times. And so it begins in December of 1939, 3 or 4 months after he's arrived. Someone denounces him, and this name is still blacked out in the files. Someone denounces him to the State Department. And a few weeks later, at the very beginning of January of 1940, the State Department passes this information on to the FBI office in New York City. And this will launch the first wave of FBI investigations of Reich. And they're looking at him for possibly subversive political activities based on some of his political activities back in Europe. Reich had no knowledge of this. At some point, and I'm not really sure, I believe he became aware of perhaps one of the second FBI investigations. But he had essentially been denounced by someone who was saying, this man is involved with the Communist Party of America. Well, Reich had renounced his communist ties years ago in Europe. When he comes to America, he will never have any kind of political affiliation and will never be politically active. So there is this first round of FBI investigations in 1940. They don't find anything incriminating about him, but he's on their radar. There is now an FBI file. They are compiling information about him. And when you read these FBI files, and the FBI files on Reich are a little over 800 pages.
Wow.
A lot of the information is wrong. A lot of it is correct. Later on, at some point, and I don't have the exact date in my head, there will be another denunciation of Reich to someone, by someone whose name still remains blacked out. And this will set off another wave of investigations of Reich around 1941. And again, they don't find anything incriminating about him, but there is something rather severe that happens. They just think, well, there's something suspicious about this guy, and the war has already started in Europe, and so at some point, because of these FBI investigations, there is a decision made. And it's very clear when it's made, because you see the back and forth. You see emails from J. Edgar Hoover and various agents. In the summer of 1941, Reich's name is put on what they call a custodial detention list. And they were doing this with hundreds and thousands of people who had come over from Europe, perhaps had come over from Asia, who they considered enemy aliens. And the custodial detention list said that if America goes to war, the people on these custodial detention lists will be taken into custody as suspected enemy aliens. And that's in the summer of 1941. Again, they have found nothing damning about him, but they think, there's still something here. We got to keep our eye on this guy. That's the summer of 1941. Several months later, December 7th, Pearl Harbor. Within a few days, America is at war with Japan, with Italy, and with Germany. On the morning of December 12th, at 2 a.m. in the morning, there's a knocking on Reich's door. It's two FBI men to take him into custody. And he is, in fact, taken into custody at 2 a.m. They will not even tell his wife where they're taking him. And he is taken from his home in Forest Hills, Queens, to the FBI headquarters in Lower Manhattan and processed there. And then he and hundreds of others who have been taken into custody once we went to war with these other countries are taken out on a ferry boat to Ellis Island. And Ellis Island, and this is a story that a lot of people don't know. Ellis Island, of course, which is the great point of entry for immigrants for decades. During World War II, it became a place where they were holding in incarceration, in custody, suspected enemy aliens. And Reich will be out at Ellis Island for 25 and a half days. His wife will eventually find out where he is. FBI agents, meantime, will visit his house with a search warrant, and they will search his library and take books and documents with them to be used as incriminating evidence. And Reich felt he, there was a danger he was going to be deported. And so when you look at the FBI files, they couldn't figure out that some suspected he was a Nazi. Others suspected he was a communist. They really couldn't make up their mind what he was. They just knew he was something, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there is a hearing in which he has to explain to a judge at this hearing why he has certain books in his library. Why does he have a biography of Hitler? Why does he have a biography of Stalin? Why does he have these books? Well, he had written a classic book in 1933 called The Mass Psychology of Fascism.
Right.
That's why he had those books, you know?
Yes.
So these kind of questions that he had to answer. After 25 and a half days, and you see this very specifically in the file, where they determine that he is not a threat. He is not a communist. He is not a fascist. He is not a Nazi. You know, we need to release him. 25 and a half days, you know? And so he is released, I believe it's January 5th. 1942, and you know, and he comes home. So that is the major effect of those two waves of FBI investigations. But what's interesting is the FBI investigations have nothing to do, absolutely nothing to do, with the FDA investigations, which will begin 5 years later. So I think it's a justifiable misconception for a lot of people to think that all of these investigations were somehow entwined. State Department, FBI investigations, and Immigration and Naturalization were all involved during this custodial detention period. The FDA investigation, 5 years later, is an entirely different animal. It does not flow out of the earlier investigations, and it becomes the most destructive investigation of all, in that it leads to ultimately to the banning and burning of his books and him, you know, ultimately ending up in prison.
This is information I didn't know. I didn't know the FBI had taken him. Is this out there in the public domain?
It is mentioned in biographies, the fact that Reich was taken to Ellis Island. That, you know, that's really nothing new. And so I've known about that for a long time. For example, his American wife, Ilsa, wrote a rather slender biography about him back in the 70s. That was among the first books that I'd read. So I knew about this episode for a long time. So it does show up in his biographies. But what's interesting is, among all the people that I've talked to over the years, just, you know, swapping stories, asking questions, no one was really aware of this whole custodial detention process by which hundreds, if not thousands, of suspected enemy aliens were put on lists and taken into custody once World War II broke out, or once we became involved in World War II. So Reich was just one among many. In answer to your question, yes, it is public domain, you know, basically, and also in terms of these government files, technically they're public domain. You just pursue them yourselves, and so. Many of these things now are available through Freedom of Information Acts and things like that. But, you know, it takes work to get them. No one's just going to hand them over to you. You know, it takes some legwork just to, you know, to get all these things. But it's all there, and I think that's one of the major things I like to get across to people is I honestly believe that in the last few years, or maybe more than a few years, any filmmaker could have done what I've done. I don't think there's anything so special about what I've done. It's a lot of hard work, but anyone could have done this hard work. There have been a lot of films about Reich, and I've crossed paths with a lot of these filmmakers. none of them, to mind I, had ever really done substantial amount of research. They were just eager to go out and do a film. The material is there, but to get the story right, you have to put in your time. And I think that's the only thing different about me than anyone else. I've put in the time. And I realized, and this certainly would have been true at the time that you and I talked a couple years ago, is I did not want to go out and raise money for this film or shoot this film till I was very clear in my mind what the storyline was. And it's a very labor-intensive process, but the material is there for anyone who wants to look through it. But it's going to take you years to go through it and really, really figure out the story. And I was willing to put the time in to do that because there's got to be one film out there that gets it right. And there is no film out there about Reich that has ever gotten it right.
Our guest is Kevin Hinchey. He's the co-director of the Wilhelm Reich Infant Trust in Rangeley, Maine. He is currently working on a documentary about Wilhelm Reich, and this is going to be a full-length documentary. Kevin, I'm really interested in the government files, and I really appreciate you explaining some of the depth of that research. What about the State Department files?
Yeah, they're actually less interesting. They're critical, but they're less interesting. They are much, much, much less in quantity. What's significant about the State Department files is the State Department often gets some information or someone denounces him within the State Department or embassy or something like that. And what happens for the most part is the State Department notifies the FBI and the FBI kind of runs with it after that. So that's the interrelationship really between the State Department and the FBI. There is clearly a springboard from the State Department into the FBI. But it is real in terms of the investigation of Reich for possibly subversive activities, and you see that at the top of these pages, Wilhelm Reich, you know, subversive activities, Communist Party, whatever, that type of thing. The substantial part of those suspicions and of those investigations are in the FBI file, not so much with the State Department. So they're intertwined.
Okay. Now, what are some of the significant turning points in Reich's life that you uncovered in your research?
The first critical turning point in his life is his meeting with Freud, and that is when he is a medical student, 22, 23 years old. After World War One, he serves in World War One, and then he goes on to medical school, and he meets Freud when he is still a medical student at the university. When Reich is at the University of Vienna, and he becomes a psychoanalyst. That's a key turning point. But then there is sort of a another turning point with Freud when they start to have conceptual differences in terms of psychoanalysis and such things about the death instinct. And Reich wants to become really feels that there needs to be really a social agenda that can change the social conditions, the authoritarian conditions which cause sexual and emotional repression. This will eventually lead to a break with Freud. Another key turning point, I would say, would be the summer of 1934 when Reich is expelled from the International Psychoanalytic Association, to which he has belonged to for many years. He's belonged to it, I don't know, 10, 11 years, I think is what it is, and he is expelled from that organization at their Congress in Lucerne in August of 1934. I think that leads to another turning point. He moves to Oslo, and one of the reasons he moves to Oslo is because he has proposed a series of experiments and to investigate energy functions in living tissue. He wants to go into the laboratory, and this will be the first time he'll go back into the laboratory since medical school. And a laboratory at the University of Oslo is being put at his disposal, or made available to him, I should say, and he's also lecturing there. And so his return to the laboratory, and we could say that's really the end of 1934, The experiments actually begin in 1935. This becomes a turning point. These first experiments are really about the biological investigation of energy in the human body, and then this will lead to other experiments about energy functions in more primitive life forms.
We're speaking with Kevin Hinchey about his upcoming full-length documentary on Wilhelm Reich. Kevin Hinchey, we're talking about his full-length documentary film project on the life and work of Wilhelm Reich.
And then we could certainly see another turning point would come at the very beginning of early 1939 in Oslo, January, and we know this, and we know we can almost date it exactly from his diary entries and his laboratory notebook entries. He discovers this biological energy in these microorganisms that he's discovered. And within a couple of months, and again, we can really date this because of his diary entries and his laboratory notebook entries, by March of 1939, he's realizing this is not electricity, this is not magnetism, this is not radioactivity, this seems to be a new form of energy, and he will call it orgone energy. You can certainly say that another turning point is his immigration to America. You know, he wants to get out of Europe for a lot of reasons. He's had a number of professional and political persecutions against him, a newspaper campaign against him, plus they're on the verge of war. This is not good for Reich, who has been an anti-fascist and an anti-Nazi. And so he comes to America. And then I would say that the next big turning point would be the beginning of the FDA investigation, which we can date to August. The FDA files really begin in August of 1947. That's almost the third act of the film, from 1947 to 1957. He is still involved in a lot of fascinating medical and scientific research, cancer research, atmospheric research. But this investigation is going on and will culminate in 1954 and 1955. So, and it's interesting you should ask that question, because in some way I do recall when I was sitting down to in a very broad way to outline the story and plan my attack in terms of research, in terms of which books I have to revisit, in which which resources do I have to revisit, and I wasn't thinking them as turning points really, but they are turning points, and so all of the different turning points that I just itemized for you were key points that I was putting down on pieces of paper to kind of chart the chronology. And I was probably thinking as a writer, well, these are high points, dramatic points. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. These are turning points. And so those became key moments and key high points in my very, very broad outline. And then it was just a matter of filling in the details, just starting from the beginning and filling in the details, and always keeping your mind on those dramatic high points. And there are other dramatic high points too, but I think I just itemized what I think are the major ones.
Oh, definitely. And his move,
to
Rangeley, Maine, was it there that he had made the connection with Oregon energy and the atmosphere?
Absolutely, that's right. It was quite by accident, and it's very interesting. I remember someone said to me once, who didn't care for Reich, they said, well, I don't really care where he took his work. And I said, well, I don't think it's so much of a matter of taking his work somewhere, but where the work took him. And the work took him into some interesting areas, and he merely followed it. So it was in the summer. It was in the summer of 1940. He had just been in America since August 1939. His original plan when he came to America, and we see in his diaries, he was exhausted when he came here. And one of the first things he wanted to do was take a long camping trip, because he loved camping. And he wanted to go camping and just be in a tent for a while. And he never got to do that when he first came to America. He finally gets to do it the following summer, and he and the woman who would become his second wife are on a camping trip through New England, through Vermont, through New Hampshire, and they end up in Rangeley. They end up in Rangeley. There's a big storm, so they can't be in the tent, and they end up renting a cabin by a lake. And he's always bringing equipment with him and studying things. And it is there in the skies above this lake, with a great name. It's Moosluk Maguntuk Lake, which is one of the Rangeley lakes, where he discovers this same energy, which he has originally discovered in microscopic cultures that he has looked at under high magnification microscopes. He discovers this same energy pulsating in the atmosphere. And so he realizes that this energy, which is in living tissue, which I have seen, under high magnification in microscopes and living tissues, must originate from the atmosphere, because it's also in the atmosphere. And so that will lead him into a whole other area of work, and that's why the Rangeley Lakes region becomes so important to him, because of its dry atmosphere, its altitude, its clean environment, and it becomes a much better place to do a lot of laboratory experiments than his laboratory in his home in Forest Hills, New York, especially in the summer, you know, where it's hot and it's muggy, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And so Rangeley becomes, he sets up first a makeshift laboratory in a cabin that he buys, and then later he buys an abandoned farm and builds a laboratory. And so this becomes a laboratory and research center. And then in 1950, he will move there permanently. And this property is now the Wilhelm Reich Museum.
I love that story. And
it's a great story. I do, too.
I'd love to visit at some point. I will get to it. It's about 5 or 6 hours from here, but at some point I'd love to see that.
Beautiful area. Beautiful.
Now, one of the drivers of producing this documentary is correcting the misrepresentations and inaccuracies of Wilhelm Reich's life. Can you list some of those misrepresentations?
Yes, I will. And that's an accurate description of it. But I don't want anyone to think that the film is structured in such a way that I'm going to that I'm almost working from a defensive posture, so called, and starting off as discussion points to the distortions and then taking them on one by one. No, that's not what I'm doing. It's just that the cumulative narration that I want viewers to see will, in and of itself, provide an accurate account of his life and work. So in terms of what I think are the key distortions about Reich's work, the first two, and to me they have equal weight, is that he claimed he could cure cancer with this scientific and medical tool, this modified Faraday cage called an orgone accumulator. If anybody out there, I will bet anyone any amount of money, that you cannot find any statement by Reich where he is claiming that he can cure cancer. But you will find many statements where he says he cannot cure cancer, there are some promising results, but he cannot cure cancer, and he is constantly taking a rather cautionary view of even his most promising results. So that's one of the primary disorders. So anyone who says, well, he claimed he could cure cancer, well, you know, show it to me. Because in the thousands and thousands of pages I've read, I've never heard Reich say it, you know, but I can give you seven or eight statements where he says he can't cure cancer. Second one is this orgone energy accumulator that I just mentioned, which is a modified Faraday cage. It is a metal-lined enclosure that people sit in the same way people have been sitting in Faraday cages since its invention in 1836 and 1837. So this next distortion is that this orgone accumulator, he was promoting it and selling it and renting it as some sort of sexual device, which could, you know, enhance sexual potency or sexual performance. This perhaps is the most damning distortion. There is an exhibit as we speak, a museum exhibit as we speak in London, which is saying exactly this. Despite the fact that the curator of that exhibit contacted me in August, and I gave her statements by Reich that said, this is not a sexual device, it didn't mean anything. You go to this exhibit, and you can see their depiction of the accumulator online. It's a sexual device. And so that is a very, also very damaging. So they're both about this modified Faraday cage, this orgone energy accumulator, it being a cancer cure and or a sexual device to increase sexual performance or increase sexual potency. This is what the FDA thought. This is what a lot of writers at the time thought when Reich was alive, and it is perpetuated ad nauseum to this day. There is also the rumor that Reich was insane, that he was psychotic, that he was mad. The origins of this rumor of Reich's possible psychosis, questions about his sanity, originate in the psychoanalytic community in the early 1930s. And they originated with a psychoanalyst named Sandor Rado. And Sandor Rado would come to America, as a lot of the psychoanalysts did, from Europe, and they would become major figures in psychoanalysis in this country. And so before Reich ever sets foot on American soil in August 1939, the rumors about him and questions about his sanity and questionable experiments and obsession with sex and all these things have already preceded him to America. And they just are precipitated. And so when you think of these various people, and in my mind, I'm trying to think of a good visual for it, you know, of the film, is you have this influx of people from psychoanalysis from Europe, largely escaping what's happening in Europe, you know, the impending war, coming to America, coming to New York, and then branching out and becoming founding members of psychoanalytic, or founding members, or I should say principal members also, of psychoanalytic and psychiatric societies all over America. Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Detroit, all these people know Reich. And so these rumors about him are everywhere by the time he gets here, and certainly when he's here. And you will see in his diaries, he has various accounts. Someone reported to me the other day that someone said Wilhelm Reich was doing this or Wilhelm Reich was doing that, you know. And so he's very aware of these rumors when he's here. It becomes an epidemic in his life, but in the end, and it's always a couple of things that get you in the end, it was the FDA buying into this idea that Reich was promoting this orgone accumulator as a cancer cure or as some sort of sexual device. You see that in the files. You see this pornographic sensibility. You see them really questioning his cancer experiments. And so those become the real lightning rods for the FDA investigation of Reich.
It's really shocking that his life was full of this type of turmoil. And yeah. I did an interview with someone who helped rewrite a book on the study of psychopathy that was originally put together in the 1930s and translated from Polish. And it was illegal at the time to study or research the condition of psychopathy. It reminds me of Wilhelm Reich writing The Mass Psychology of Fascism and how that he was responded to. So it was not legal to research psychopaths. So I'm sure it was not easy to write the book that he did at that time as well.
Well, you're talking about Mass Psychology of Fascism.
Yes.
Yes, and that was something that he moves from Vienna to Berlin, really for political reasons. He's very, very involved at that point in the socialist parties and the communist parties, which, you know, at the time they were really one of the few options you had to fighting Nazism, and he felt that he could be even more politically involved in Berlin, where the parties are larger. So he moves to Berlin in the fall of 1930, becomes politically active, continues his psychoanalytic and psychiatric careers, and he is gathering information over several years about the political situation. In the meantime, he publishes a book called The Sexual Struggle of Youth, which was addressing sexual issues written for young people. That book will be banned by the Communist Party. It will be banned by the Nazi Party. The ban by the Nazi Party and an article about it in the Nazi newspaper appears at around the same time that Hitler is consolidating power. And that's why Reich literally gets out of Berlin one night, leaves Berlin. Hitler's consolidated his power. SA troops have already come to his apartment. The Nazi newspaper has condemned his book. The communists want to have nothing to do with that youth book. And he leaves, and he goes back to Vienna. And within a short period of time, he finishes the manuscript that he has been working on in Berlin, which will become The Mass Psychology of Fascism. And so it will be published shortly after he leaves Berlin in 1933. It is a book that will anger both communists and Nazis, because he is discussing fascism as manifested in both communism and Nazism. And the book will achieve a certain notoriety in people wanting to read it, because it's really taking on a lot of these authoritarian issues head on, and really goes to the heart of another major theme of his life and legacy. So many different people from different political stripes or different professions, it seems there was something about Reich to offend everyone, that he was really taking on major issues that transcended political boundaries, that transcended professional boundaries. Here you have a book that both the Nazis and the communists really took issue with about Reich. And it's a wonderful book, and he would reprint revised editions of it a couple times in America. But it first came out shortly after him fleeing Nazi Germany at the end of February, beginning of March.
Kevin, where have you traveled so far in gathering interviews for this documentary?
Actually, while I have been compiling a list of people I want to be interviewed for the film, none of my research and writing depended on me talking to anyone. And I think this is a significant issue. In terms of previous filmmakers, I feel that previous filmmakers have relied too much on other people's opinions about Reich and have almost seen that as their research. I know this material well enough, for example. What if I were to go out and interview someone and they said something about Reich or Reich's work that I knew was just factually wrong? And you need interviews for the film to kind of amplify certain things, but I wanted a storyline that was going to lay out the facts as documented in primary materials. So in my storyline, explanations about Reich's work are in Reich's own writings. Now, I want to do interviews with people to see if they can amplify on that, but I did not ever seek out, maybe with a couple of exceptions, to ask a couple people, a few scientific issues of things I didn't know about. Mm-hmm. But none of my research so far relied on any kind of interviews. But the interviews that I do want to do are people in America and people throughout Europe, many of whom I've already contacted, saying to them, I am now in the middle. I've done this over the years, and I've sent them pages I've written so they can see what I've done. And I've said, there are specific issues in here that should I get the money for this film and start to make this film, I would like you to be an interview subject to address some of these issues. And I'm still putting that list together, but these are people in America and they're people overseas, but none of them were anything that I have relied on to this point in my storyline. But they will be very valuable for the film.
How will listeners be able to find out more about this film and maybe help support it?
Well, that would be nice. I'm currently involved in a Kickstarter effort, an online, what they call crowdsourcing. This is something I've never done before. It's not something I wanted to do, quite honestly. I spent a lot of time while I was researching and writing, talking to various people, hoping I could get funding for this film. But what I discovered is these false narratives about Reich that you and I have been talking about, they precede you everywhere. And so I've gone to people who I wanted perhaps to get money from. Maybe they knew nothing about Reich. But after that first conversation, between the first and second conversation, they went on the internet and picked up all kinds of nonsense about Reich. And suddenly, you know, they're not that interested anymore. And so I was not able to get traditional funding for this film, so I went through this Kickstarter. And the way Kickstarter works is you set a time limit and a financial goal. The budget that I have for this, for at least the first part of the production of the film, the actual production of it, to go out and actually shoot footage and interviews, all these various places, I set a figure of around $168,500. That's the amount of money I'm trying to raise. As we speak now, the number should probably be up by the time the show airs. We're at around $100,000. But we only have a few days to raise the rest. We've had support coming in from all kinds of people. So what I would say to people very quickly, just Google this, Wilhelm Reich Kickstarter. It will bring you up to the site. And what you will see there is a title that says The Wilhelm Reich Documentary Film Project by me, Kevin Hinchy. And you'll see a large color photo of Reich, one of the few color photos existing of Reich. And it's really become kind of our logo for the film, this photograph of Reich. And you'll see a play button there. Click on the play button, and you will watch a six-minute project video of me talking about the film. Kickstarter requires that a project creator have a video, which really explains what the film is about. And so I explain the film, and then you'll see various ways that you can pledge to this, and you'll see the amount that we've raised by that point and how far we still have to go. So we have a long way to go in a very short period of time, but we're very hopeful, because we have had support coming literally from people all over the world for this, and we've been very encouraged by the emails they send us along with their pledges. Or I thank everyone. At the end of the night, I thank everyone who donated that day, and I give my email, and a lot of people write back, and a lot of people are excited about this film. But as I sit here right now talking to you, Jeff, we need many more backers to really make this campaign successful. The campaign will end at 8:21 on Friday, November 21st. And the way Kickstarter works is you set a financial goal. You have to make that financial goal in its entirety, or else you get none of the money.
That's right.
And so
that's the way it works.
And that's the way it should work, you know, because if you set a figure for what you need to make the quality film you need, well, if you're not going to get that money, you can't ask people to give you money to make a sub-quality project, you know. So that's what it is. It's all or nothing. And we're still remaining very hopeful and really working hard at this. And we really appreciate the support we have been getting from all over the world, and some very nice emails from a lot of people, a few of Reich's former students who are now rather elderly, are on board with this, and they've been helping. And it's been a very exciting fundraising Kickstarter campaign.
Great. Well, Kevin Hinchey, co-director of the Wilhelm Reich Infant Trust in Rangeley, Maine. I'm thinking positive, and I can't wait to.
Thank you very much, Jeff. You've always been terrific and very supportive. I appreciate it.
I can't wait to see this film. I'm really looking forward to it.
You know, I can't wait to call up the crew and say, we got the money. Let's go out and do this.
It's going to happen.
But I hope everyone will go to the site and look at the project video. And I hate to be a shameless shill here, Jeff, but I am going to. And by the time you hear this, there's only a few days left, so please go to the site and please donate whatever level is comfortable for you. Every little bit helps. Thanks.
Kevin, thank you for being on In Other News.
You're very welcome, Jeff. It's been a pleasure.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again on Dark Matter Radio. Thank you.